All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fucking ears? What the fuck Knicks? What the fucking Ucks? I am in Toronto as I'm saying this. What have I got to tell you, people? I am Mark Maron. This is WTF. Thank you for listening to my show. We've got an interesting guest because I wonder how many of you know him or know his work. Josh Groban is on the show today. He's a Twitter pal of mine, and he's a huge record-selling machine. People love Josh Groban. Who is Josh Groban? Who loves Josh Groban? It would be easy for me to condescend the world of Josh Groban, but I chose to engage Josh in a nice conversation about his world. He's a crooner, an old-style kind of adult pop crooner. I don't even know how you'd categorize it. I have to talk to him about it. But I was curious, man. This cat has sold some fucking wax. But he's a good guy, and it's an interesting story, and I was thrilled to talk about it because it's popular music, folks. Someone out there is buying those records, and he's a very unsuspecting character for this type of stuff, but people love the guy's voice, and he's a good guy. And you'll hear me talk to him in a few minutes. What do I got to tell you? What's going on tonight on the show? Maron is an episode that I wrote called Mark's Family. It features Judd Hirsch. Sally Kellerman is my mother, and Dave Cross plays Dave Cross. I'm going to try to give you some behind the scenes, because sometimes I don't know if you know exactly how casting goes and whatnot, but we wanted to have a podcast guest on this episode, the episode I was writing, and we needed somebody for reasons that will become revealed to you that smoked weed. So I thought, Seth Rogen would be great. So I wrote the part for Seth Rogen, assuming we could get Seth Rogen. You never know who you're going to get. And it's not really a matter of whether or not someone can play the part, or it's really about availability. There's a lot of goodwill out there for my show, and I'm happy about that. And I contacted Seth because he'd been on my show. And, I said, I'd like to write you into this episode. I think you'd be perfect for the part. Turns out he had to go to Vancouver. So then we got to figure out who can do this part. And then, Dave Cross and I, of course, are great old friends, and he can do anything. He's really one of the funniest guys in the world. So I reached out to Dave, and it turns out he was going to be in town and he could do it. The problem is that sometimes there's a missing link in the chain, and they sent a script out to Dave and he showed up to shoot. He walked in and he said, I didn't understand. I was reading the script and I didn't understand who I was, because I saw, okay, there's Mark and there's Seth Rogen. And I didn't know what part I was playing. And then I realized I'm playing Seth Rogen. Very awkward. And had it been anybody else, it would have been really awkward. But Dave was fucking hilarious, and he's hilarious in the episode. It's a great episode. Also, this is you'll see more of the character established briefly in the first season of my brother. There was a quick phone call in season one with my brother, but in this, Troy Ruptosh plays. It's all about me and my brother. It the whole episode revolves around me and my fictional brother, played by Troy, who actually, and it's a little known fact, and I believe it's true, he plays the original Don Draper. He plays the Don Draper that was killed in Korea. The Don Draper who Don Draper steals his name from is Troy Ruptosh, and he plays my brother. But I'm very proud of this episode. As I said, it came out of my mind. I did the original script for it, and I hope you enjoy it. Dave is hilarious, and it's always great to see Cross. Oh, next weekend. Is it next weekend? Weekend after this weekend. Is that next weekend? Yes. Yes, it is. So I believe the 27th, the 28th, Bloomington, Indiana at the Comedy Attic. Please come if you're in the area. I think there's tickets. I don't know. I know I'll be in Lawrence, Kansas also next week. I think there might be a few tickets. Just go to WTFpod.com and check the calendar, okay? I'm sorry. I should be more organized. I'm traveling a lot. I think my sinuses are screwed up. And I just got 3 boxes of Goo Goo Clusters from Nashville. I don't know how many people listen to the show. This is not a sponsorship thing, man. And it's one of those situations where I don't know what to do. I mean, I mentioned I never had them before, and then they had Goo Goo Cluster picks, guitar picks, and I talked about it on the Vince Vaughn episode. So I get this box today at the P.O. box, three boxes of three different kinds of Goo Goo Clusters, three different kinds, 12 in a box, a hat, which I liked, a mug, which I'll use, a t-shirt, which I'll run in, because I'm going to have to after I eat three boxes of fucking Goo Goo Clusters, original, super kind, peanut butter. I mean, this is one of those situations where, like, this is one of the benefits. This is one of the perks. But now I'm going to be tortured by these Goo Goo Clusters. There's just going to be Goo Goo Clusters just crying my name like sirens in a freezer. And I'm not tied to the mast of a boat. I can just go to the freezer. Oh, I'm going to need that shirt to run in. They should have sent me more shirts and another hat because I'm going to have to run all the Goo Goo Clusters off. I cannot go on being this tortured by food. What I'm trying to say is thank you. What came out? Did something else come out? Did it sound like a complaint? So some of you saw me on Louie on Monday. I didn't know when it was going to be on, but he saved it for the finale. And I got a DVR'd. I got to watch it. It looked like it got some good feedback. It seems that people are enjoying the old switcheroo, the role reversal that was established in my interview with Louis C.K. I'm always thrilled and honored to be asked to be on the show. I was happy he asked me last season. I was happy that he came up with this angle this season. I hope you enjoyed that. Hopefully, you know, if we get another season of Maron, I don't know yet. Hopefully we'll get Louis on Maron as Louis, I think would be the best way to do it. But we're doing good. We talk occasionally, we're friends, and that's all leveled off, and that's great. I'm talking to my father. I called my father on Father's Day. We're friends, and that's great. I'm having some trouble with Deaf Black Cat. I don't know why he's abandoned me. He showed up to basically, I told you, to say hello, and that was that. And now I don't see him anymore. Maybe he'll check in as soon as I get worried again, but I guess cats don't really give a shit. You know, I don't want to admit that, and I know my cats love me, but I don't know how long that love would last, given a few days away. Maybe a week or two. But I guess Deaf Black Cat's getting some better food somewhere else, and that's just the way it is, as long as he checks in occasionally to let me know he's moved on. You know, I mean, just, you can leave the nest, but drop by occasionally for holidays, maybe for a little something to eat every once in a while. That's all I'm asking. Is that wrong? The crooners seem to be around a lot more. Now it seems to be sort of a throwback, but I don't think Josh Groban's really a throwback. He's a crooner for this age. He's not doing some shtick. He's not doing a Sinatra shtick. He's doing his own thing. I remember one of the first cassettes I had was one of my parents' cassettes. It was a Jerry Vale tape. He was a crooner, wasn't he? All I remember was him doing a cover of Little Green Apples. God didn't make little green apples and it don't rain in many Indianapolis. Where is it? In the summertime. Crooning is not my thing. Clearly not my thing. But I was excited to talk to Josh Groban. So why don't we do that now? Why don't we listen to me and Josh Groban? You'll be surprised. Surprised, not surprised. I like surprised. Surprised, I understand. Surprised, I've not defined yet. What the fuck? 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 Yeah, I do play guitar, Josh. Do you play guitar?
No, not at all. I grew up playing piano. Piano and drums. The stringed instruments. Anything I need to put my finger on a string and build a callus.
Did you just turn me up?
Did I turn you up? I apologize.
I was wondering, like, is happening?
Oh, sorry.
The second one's you.
That's me. Sorry.
How's that better?
That's great.
I was like, I've got a lot of Josh Groban in my head.
More me.
Yeah.
More me.
The guy, he's really good with his voice. I've never had
sense.
Anyone.
Have a sense, the host.
Never heard anybody
me.
So clearly project into my head.
Before you know it, I'll have reverb on me.
Fuzz. Some echo.
Yeah, exactly.
Wait, just ricocheting in my brain. The dulcet sounds of Josh Groban's voice ricocheting conversationally in my mind.
That's right.
I just use the word dulcet. Is that the right word?
Yeah, sure. Dulcet. Dulcet tones, they say.
Dulcet tones.
Yes, my dulcet baritone will reverberate throughout your...
That's been written about you. Dulcet baritone.
When lucky.
Are you a baritone or a tenor?
I would say I'm a baritone.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. There was a time when I was really... thinking to myself, oh well, you know, I'm a baritone working on becoming a tenor, and then I thought, you know what, I like singing low,
So. Yeah?
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting to me, like, you're here because we have common friends, and, you know, I see your funny shit on Twitter, and somehow or another, I've identified a struggle in your life, and that is to reconcile the reality of, you know, your profession and what you're very good at and make a fortune doing.
Thank you.
And people love and enjoy.
Okay.
And the fact that you're just a dude who likes to hang out.
Yeah.
Like, how old are you?
I'm 33.
So you're 33. You want to have some peers, some, you know, you're pretty groovy guy.
Okay.
So at some point, you know, I think maybe I'm wrong because I'm projecting. So there's quite a possibility that I'm wrong that at some point you have to actually have a somewhat ironic detachment from what you are known as in the world, you know, in order to integrate into, you know, the sort of community that, you know, you like hanging out in, like, you know, Tim and Eric or me or the Nerdist or the comedy world.
Sure. Well, I mean, we're not all one thing. And I think that, you know, certainly I was signed at 17 years old. And I was signed with a fairly large classical style singing voice. So the marketing campaign around that kind of a singing voice is always going to be, you know, is going to have some, you know, certainly a lot of gravitas to it. A lot of billboards that look like a staring contest in the desert, you know. And, you know, I still, you know, I mean, we still like to hang out. I don't know many classical singers that don't like to hang out.
But just by virtue, is that what you call yourself, a classical singer?
I would say classical pop singer. I would say that my training has been classical, while my music has been more on the pop side.
Okay, well, we're going to go through that history in a minute. But I do
love absurdist comedy. I do love being around funny people. I do love being, quote unquote, you know, a normal dude, as you said, you know, when I'm not on stage, because I think we need to turn off that side of our voice, that side of our brains. I mean, and, you know, there's a certain person that I flip into when I'm on stage and when I have to perform. And then
sure, you're a show business person.
The moment that I'm off stage, it turns off.
Right. Well, I think what I'm getting at, what's interesting to me is, you know, I tweeted this morning, could somebody please point me towards the best Josh Groban album?
Yes. So many people pointed that just you can't see that.
No, they were very. I saw a few people, a few women were like, yeah. "Oh, you got it," you know. And then they.
Oh no! You stirred the haters.
Not only haters, but they're condescending. I mean, I think yes, they're haters, but it's because they don't listen at all. They've made assumptions.
Yes, of course.
About who you are and your music,
sure.
and frankly,
no, which is totally understandable.
Right. Yeah. And this morning, I'm like, well, I better listen to some Josh Groban. He's coming over, and you know, and I listened to some. I got the beauty and the depth of your voice, and I understand how you could make women weep and excited.
Yeah, sure.
And
yeah.
I, you know, and I'm not saying that just women, that men too.
But it's not your thing. I mean, it's not everybody's thing. It's you know, we all have different tastes, and that's great.
Okay, so but this is a thing. The type of music you're doing in one form or another, I think has been around for a long time.
I
mean, the type of music you're doing was popular music, you know, probably into the mid 50s.
Yes,
and that was it.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That this was it. You know, it was probably more big band driven, or probably more.
Sure. But it was the pop music of its time. You know, whether you're talking about big band, or you're talking about Enrico Caruso, or you're talking about these art songs, these love songs. You know, and it was at a time when you didn't need to sound like a chipmunk to be on. You know, popular consciousness. People had big voices. They had big vibrato. They weren't afraid to kind of let that beast out. And that was considered like the romantic thing. Now it's very small. But I think I sing full-throatedly and
you know, and sort of I just don't. There's a tempo to it. I don't know what you would call it. But
slow.
Yeah, slow tempo. But I mean, there is a easy listening element.
Okay.
Or something that was once categorized that. I mean, I'm saying that, like, in a lot of ways, the type of pop music you're doing has been around longer than most of the other pop music.
Right. Yeah, I would say it's a very traditional style of pop music.
Right.
Yeah.
And so that audience is that audience.
Yeah. When people ask me, you were asking me, do I think of myself as a classical singer? I actually really don't. I mean, the music that I sing, I would consider a traditional style of pop music. Yeah.
Right. Right. Like, if for some reason, I think of records, you know, that my parents, you know, I have the first bunch of cassette tapes that I sort of came upon. Because my parents had them.
Yeah.
You know, one of them was Jerry Vale.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
sure.
Like those guys.
Yeah.
That they're sort of like, you know, they were modern crooners, you know, in the 60s.
Sure.
You know, I don't know.
They had great lush orchestrations. I mean, mm-hmm. there was just as much emphasis on who the arranger was. The arrangers were superstars.
Kurt Bacharach was a big guy with this stuff, right?
Absolutely.
Am I wrong?
Yeah, totally. And they're timeless. And, You know, that's a, it's an era that, that comes around. And I think my challenge, you know, being, you know, now I'm not as young, but when I started, is, you know, how do I find a way to make this relevant today, to find an audience today?
But you found an audience.
No, well, I was very lucky. I was very fortunate. I had a record label that said, you know, we're not expecting anything from you. If we can break even, we'll be thrilled.
Is that true?
Yeah. Well, they didn't want to, nobody wanted to sign me. When I got signed, we, you know, my producer at the time, David Foster, said, look, kid, we're on our own here. This is a passion project for us.
Well, that's interesting. So let's lead up to that. Where were you born?
At Cedars-Sinai.
You're right here.
Born in Los Angeles. Yeah.
And both your parents lived here.
Yep.
Are they still here?
Yeah, they're here.
And they're married?
They're married 48 years.
So so you're relatively healthy.
Yeah, I had a Norman Rockwell childhood.
Norman Rockwell.
Yeah. I had the onesie. We had epic Christmases. It was you know.
Christmases. Groban sounds Jewish to me, not Jewish.
Yeah, my father's side of the family is Jewish.
Uh-huh.
My dad converted when he married my mom, which was a big scandal in the family.
Wow, it usually goes the other way.
It usually does go the other way.
He must have loved her. She just wouldn't tolerate a Jew in that. House, huh?
No, we were raised very, very open-minded about religion. I mean, uh-huh. We did the Christian holidays, but other than that.
But you must have Groban grandparents that are like, ay, ay, ay.
Very much so. On my father's side of the family. And I love that side of my family. I feel very, very attached to my Jewish roots. And so...
What kind of background does your mom have?
My mom has a Norwegian background. So
that's
interesting,
she's
Scandinavian,
huh?
Yeah.
Scandinavian, that's some sturdy stock there.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Viking power.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, we, you know, a lot of relatives in Minnesota.
I'm willing to bet that your genetic line needed that. A little infusion of Viking doesn't hurt a Jewish line.
Doesn't hurt anybody. No, it doesn't at all. Yeah, if I have any muscle mass whatsoever, uh-huh. Then it's from that side of the family for sure.
But, okay, so your father did what?
My dad, well, he played jazz trumpet all through school. So
really?
He was a jazzer all growing up.
You grew up with that in the house?
I grew up with that in the house. My dad played albums. He would play the trumpet sometimes. You know, but his parents said to him, music is no way to make a living, you know, that you go into business. So he's been in the executive search field. He's what they call a headhunter. He's been doing that for years and years and years and still does it.
And he still plays occasionally or no?
He hasn't taken out the horn in a long, long time. I was actually in D.C. with Wynton Marsalis. We were testifying to Congress for arts education. For arts, yeah, I know. Arts education. We were trying to get the arts funding bill passed.
Really? You went and did that? Who were some of the other people involved in that?
It was myself, Linda Ronstadt, and Wynton Marsalis. And every year they get a few people to do it. And that was the year that I testified.
To get money for the kids.
Yeah, and it's a bit of a dog and pony show for Congress, because mm-hmm. they know, you know, already what they're going to put into it, and it's going to be chump change. And, you know, you do it and hopefully raise awareness and get people to get more and more every year. But Wynton asked my dad about playing, and he said, you know, I'm going to call you at some point. I mean, I better find out that you've been playing. And he got out the trumpet, and he started playing, and he still has the lip. And
how did Wynton know your dad?
I introduced them in D.C. My parents came out with me when I testified. And so Wynton kind of pressured him to start playing again. And so
what's his style? Is it Miles or is it Chet
no,
Baker?
No, it's neither. He worked with a guy named Ziggy Elman,
uh-huh.
who it was a very kind of almost like kind of a almost jazzy klezmer kind of stuff. Very wide vibrato kind of stuff. Yeah,
gypsy-ish.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, exactly. Uh-huh. So he would kind of almost croon on the trumpet, you know. And we've got old recordings of him playing, and he could play.
Yeah,
yeah, he was good.
So when you were a kid, that was around.
That was around. Yeah, and my parents are both. They're very musical, very artistic. Never went into it professionally. So
what'd your mom do?
So my mom was an art teacher. She was a high school art teacher. She taught Crispin Glover was one of her students.
Really? Look what she did to him.
Yeah, exactly. She hasn't taken credit for that, but she should. You know,
he's done something.
That was right before the Letterman interview, I think, that
really?
She taught him. No, I don't know. Probably.
Well, he was acting since he was in high school, probably.
Yeah.
Where'd she teach?
She taught at Merman School, a place called Merman School here in L.A. But you know, growing up in Los Angeles, it's a cultural melting pot if you choose for it to be. You know, it's like you just got to throw the kids in the car and go. And they did. They took us out. We would go to the music center. We'd see classical music for kids. We would build a time machine in the lobby out of cardboard, and then Beethoven would pop out and play with the LA Phil.
It's nice to hear the good parenting.
Yeah,
that you know you have a parent who is a teacher and a father who gives a shit.
Yeah.
You know, they want to open the kid's mind.
I was so fortunate, both my brother and I. And
how old is your brother?
My brother is just turned to see 29. So
what's he doing?
He's a film editor, and and director, and you know, we have the same birthday, 4 years apart. So,
interesting.
Yeah, crazy.
So did you, when you were growing up, was show business just the industry of Los Angeles in your mind? Did you grow up with a lot of kids who were, parents were in show business? And
I did.
Because it's interesting when I talk to people who grew up in LA that they, the way they think about, you know, entertainment and show business and movies and music and everything else is slightly different than those outsiders, because you, like, you're dealing with kids, you're dealing with people that want to do it, that see it as a reasonable avenue because you live in an industry town.
For sure, from day one. I mean, it's, you know, we're not here because the streets are paved with gold. It's like a, it's a thing you just kind of live and breathe since you're in elementary school. You're around kids that are like, oh, that's...
Whose kids did you know?
Well, one of the reasons why I eventually was played for David Foster was that I was going to school with a kid named Matt Riggs, whose father was a very famous voice teacher named Seth Riggs.
Uh-huh.
And we would have like sleepovers, and we would have birthday parties, and Stevie Wonder and Michael Jackson would be walking out of the house because he would teach them, like, at
really?
The house. Yeah. And so it was that.
How old were you?
I was like 10.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, it
was, so he was the guy.
He was the guy. Yeah, he was the guy. You know, we knew. I went.
But where does that story go from there?
Nowhere. He wound up giving me lessons. He wound up having a group of kids that Matt went to school with come for a free music lesson.
Oh, to show them, to encourage them.
Yeah, to encourage them. Right. Yeah, exactly. Uh-huh. Here's what my dad does. He's going to give us all a lesson.
Oh, that's fun.
And he's running us through scales, and I was super shy about my own voice because I was a total late bloomer. My voice didn't even change.
So how old were you at this time?
I was probably 12, 13.
Okay.
And all of a sudden I sing a few scales, and he's like, oh, that's very good. That's very, I'm going to give you more lessons. So he let me come over for free. You know, we would do a few lessons. Eventually I started paying him, but it was David Foster who called him and said, hey, I'm in a clinch. Who have you got who's young, who can sing? I was at that point 15, 16 years old. He sent him my tape, and the rest is history.
Okay. Well, let's talk about that history.
Sure.
Because I'd like to talk about that.
Sure.
So you're 15 years old. You're taking lessons with this guy, Riggs.
Yeah.
Because he sees talent.
Yeah.
And he obviously wants to, nurture your talent, because he's letting you do it for nothing.
Yeah.
I assume that was the interest. He must have been sort of fascinated.
Sure.
And so this guy Foster, who does, tell me about him, because I don't know him.
Okay, so David Foster, he's got 14 Grammys. He's produced everything from the Whitney Houston Bodyguard album to Chicago to Boss Scaggs to, you know, a lot of stuff. A lot of vocalists, you know.
He 70s does, guy.
Yeah, he did a lot of stuff in the 70s, 80s, 90s. And today, you know, he's now the head of Verve Records at Universal.
Verve Records,
mm-hmm.
Still around.
Oh yeah, still around.
I got some stuff from Vanguard. Were they reissuing their old catalog as well, or
and
what?
New? I mean, they've got a lot of amazing.
Are you on Verve?
I'm not. I'm on Warner Brothers, but he's doing great over there, and he's got you know, people like Jamie Cullum, a lot of jazz.
That was the jazz label for years.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So he's like, you know, he's in a pinch for what?
Okay. So why
does a guy need a singer right away?
So he's been charged with being the. He's been given the job of being music director for, at that time, the governor of California was Gray Davis. He had just been elected, and they're doing this big concert at the arena, Arco Arena in Sacramento. And they were going to get Michael Crawford from Phantom of the Opera to sing a big song from that. And he got sick, pulled out. So he calls Seth and he's like, you know what? I don't need a big star. Who have you got as a young kid who can sing in this style? And I'll just throw him out there. And
did you know the song?
I learned it. You know, Seth goes, oh, you know, David needs somebody to sing. Go with my friend, record this song on a cassette. And I did. I learned it. And I sent it to him. He sent it to him with five other singers, by the way. And he called me up and he goes, hey man, yeah, you were a little flat, but you were good. I liked your sound, you know.
A little flat.
We can work on that. And so he had me come in, and all of a sudden I'm in an ill-fitting tuxedo in front of 25,000 people with a full orchestra.
25,000.
It was
people.
In the round. The stage was in the middle, and they had surrounded it. It was.
You've never been on stage before.
I had been on stage at my junior high school in front of 200 people.
Doing,
I
mean, what?
Doing Fiddler, being the skinniest Tevye and Fiddler on the Roof.
So you were doing ZBDBDoo.
Yeah, if I were ever, I have five daughters. So, you know.
In junior high you did that?
In junior high, yeah.
Fiddler, you had the little beard.
Oh, I had the beard.
Did
I
you
had
have
the
a fake belly.
I had the whole thing. Totally. Yeah, I had the whole thing. You know. And I had. Oh God, that cast was really, really hysterical.
But did people resonate with your voice then? The parents that came to see Fiddler.
Yeah, they were.
Were you already sort of like, oh my God?
Yeah, because my voice at that point was you know, got the attention of Foster. It had changed. Yeah, thank God. And I was singing this stuff pretty big because I had a pretty operatic voice back then, and so. Yeah, I don't think they were expecting that from a 17-year-old high school student. Usually, you know,
is
you
that on? Do you have that on film?
It's all on YouTube.
It is on YouTube.
Somebody leaked it all on
really?
YouTube. Oh yeah, it's hysterical. Yeah,
oh, that is hilarious.
It's fun. I'm proud of it. You know, it's good. So that was kind of the first thing that I had done, and then it went straight from that to this event with David. So I was very much a student and a professional pretty much at the same time back then, and it was terrifying.
So 25,000 people.
Yeah.
And you didn't shit your pants. You didn't throw up. Didn't sweat.
This was before Depends was a thing. Yeah, I was sweating. I was you know, sharing a dressing room with, God, it was the weirdest. I think I was sharing a dressing room with like Edward James Olmos and Coolio.
Mm-hmm.
Like it was a very, very odd.
Coolio was around a lot for a little while.
That was right before he did Hollywood Squares. Yeah.
Yeah. Like he was everywhere for a minute.
He was. That was Gangster's Paradise time. That was that was amazing.
That was his only time, wasn't it?
It was an amazing. It was an epic time. I mean, yeah. Really, that was.
Sometimes you only get one big one, right?
You know, sometimes.
Hey,
yeah.
It happens a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, that was that.
So you're there 25,000.
My dad's in the back row. He's taking a shaky video of it, you know. And I remember just that was my first time experiencing what it felt like to just kind of be in that Nike Just Do It kind of zone. Like I was so nervous. I was pacing backstage. And I don't remember a thing about being on stage. I just remember kind of just feeling like, all right, I got this thing I need to do. And when I walked off stage and I had seen that I'd gotten a standing ovation, it was just this thing where I said, okay, this is something I can do. I didn't expect to continue doing it. I expected to go back to school.
Also, you were kind of a marvel. You're what, 17?
Yeah, I was 17.
And people were like, holy shit.
Yeah,
did they bring you out as a 17-year-old?
Oh, yeah. So David knew what he was doing, too. Right. You know,
if he's
not going to get the superstar, then he's going to he's going to create an ambiance around.
The wonder kind.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, the 17-year-old, you know, scrawny kid. So, you know, so I gave David a hug, and I just said, hey, thank you so much for allowing me this opportunity. I went back to school. I was intolerable for a couple of days, you know, in class, you know. Yeah. But then I just expected, you know, that was it. You know, so we all get a chance to do something like that.
Really?
And that was, I didn't have aspirations to be, you know, on a stage in front of thousands of people with a microphone being me.
Right.
I expected to do theater. I expected to maybe do some acting, maybe some comedy, whatever. But I wasn't ever expecting, especially at that time period where we were in the NSYNC days. We were in the,
right.
You know, it was... If you wanted to be a pop star or a recording star, that was not the kind of voice to have.
Right. Yeah. So, okay. So, but at that time, because it sounds like you could handle some opera if you wanted.
I was studying it. Sure.
You were studying
it
in high school.
In high school. I was taking voice lessons on the side. I was actually studying. I was at a great public school here in LA called the Los Angeles County High School for the Arts, LACSA.
Uh-huh.
And I was there as a drama major, and I would take voice lessons on the side. I was working with Seth still. I was working with a guy named David Romano. And
so you knew you had this gift.
I did. But I don't know. I knew I could sing, but I was very shy about it for a very, very long time.
I find it to be the most vulnerable, terrifying thing you can do.
Yeah.
Because I don't have any chops. So, you know, all I can do is sing as, you know, authentically as possible. And I can carry a tune. But to me, it's like, you know, I'll talk about almost anything.
Right.
And I'll put myself out there. But, you know, when I'm singing, it's terrifying.
Well, I feel that way when I look at great stand-up comedians and I say to myself, God, what kind of glutton for punishment would put themselves in this kind of a naked position?
Well, that's weird. I don't know why exactly I feel like it's so naked. Maybe because, you know, to me, like, I'm so tenuous about it or maybe I don't have any confidence in it. But, you know, when somebody takes the stage as a singer.
Right.
You know, I don't, especially somebody who does the type of thing you do.
Right.
I don't think people are like thinking like, oh, he's wide open.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? Like they want the song to enchant them.
Sure.
You have the protection of the song in a way.
Well.
And if you deliver it well.
Sure.
It's magic works.
Yes. And sometimes you deliver it as well as you thought you could do. And the audience is just clinking their plates and it's dead.
They,
you know, you can bomb as a singer just as you can bomb as a comedian. You know, it's.
Is that true?
Yeah, absolutely. You play certain charity events. You play some certain stuff where people just aren't in the mood to listen
but
to anything.
But they don't pay attention.
They're not paying attention.
But still, you got a band behind you.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah,
you know, you can still kind of get lost in your thing.
There are different levels of things you can hide behind in music. I don't have backup dancers or anything like that, but I do have a band. Yes,
right. And you don't do lip syncing.
No,
ever.
No, of course, never.
So even in that first moment where you're singing for 25,000 people, you had confidence in your voice. You knew the song was a good song. People identified this song.
Yeah.
But do you necessarily ever feel vulnerable?
Every time I walk out on stage. It's terrifying. I think confidence is an interesting thing because once you feel like it wasn't until very recently, maybe in the last 4 years, that I started to feel like, all right, I've put in my 10,000 hours, I've put in my experience, I've been through enough trial by fire moments. And David was a master in his mentorship of really putting me in very, very terrifying positions. Like there was a moment backstage where I said to him, look, I have a sore throat. I'm not feeling good tonight. There's a song he wanted me to do that just had this super high note in it.
What song?
It was called The Prayer. It was a song that he had done with Andrea Bocelli and Celine Dion. And that was a song that he had me do at a Grammy rehearsal when I was 17, which kind of got the ball rolling. And so he had me do it at this event. And it's, and I said, you know, is it okay if I just don't do the note tonight? He goes, yeah. They're not in it for the note. They're in it for whatever else. They want to hear the quality of your voice. Don't worry about the note.
Yeah.
Feel better. I go up on stage, and
the quality of the note.
He just said basically just sing as well as you can, and that'll be enough. I go out on stage, and 5 seconds before I'm supposed to hit that note, which I'm thinking to myself, I'm gonna mark it tonight.
What does market mean?
Means I'm gonna pick a different note or not sing it full voice. Go under the note.
Yeah.
And he gets on his microphone at the piano and he goes, "Here comes the money note." You know, it's basically like forcing me right in the moment to just go ahead and sing it. And I did. And
he said that out loud?
He said that out loud on mic to all the people.
To get a laugh?
In the middle of the song. No, just to fuck with me. Just to basically say.
So it was a loose situation.
It was a very stressful situation. He just knew that I was trying to cop out. And he's like, that was his way of saying, if you want to play in the big leagues, you got to hit the fucking note.
And he knew you were in a situation where he could fuck with you.
Totally.
Right.
Absolutely. Well, absolutely.
It wasn't a big gig.
I was so neurotic. I mean, yeah. I was always.
How old were you then?
18, 19.
Oh, so this is at the beginning.
This was at the beginning.
Before you recorded.
I'm still neurotic. But yes, we were in the middle of recording my first album.
Uh-huh.
So this was at a time where nobody cared. Nobody knew, you know, and
you hit it?
I hit it. Yeah, I did. Yeah.
Lesson learned.
Lesson learned.
You can turn off sickness.
You can.
For the duration of your performance.
You absolutely can.
No, yeah. You absolutely can. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But all right, so let's go back. So you do the 25,000 people. You do one song, big hit. You go back to school. Now I got to assume the people you're hanging out with, you know, are not, unless you're hanging out with the theater kids.
Yeah,
you didn't get your balls busted at all for what you know your interest was.
That's the nice thing about being in an art school.
Oh,
is
right.
that everybody is taking the train from God knows where,
right.
But they're all coming from the same point of light.
There's no football team.
No. And I went to a private school before that. Uh-huh. And yeah, no, of course. I was just, you know, basically hung on the fence by my underwear.
Gilded cage.
Yes.
There.
It was for sure. You know, so
for the singing bird.
Yeah, no, exactly. So I was fortunate. You know, I made a lot of great friends there, many of which are still my best friends today. And so it's a special place. We need more of those kind of schools.
No, I agree with you, man. You know, the fight that the creative kids have to fight to main, you know, to do what they want to do or be what they want to be in the face of fucking morons.
Yeah. And
it's disastrous.
I didn't start going to that school until 11th grade. And coincidentally, 11th grade is when I got my first girlfriend. You know, I just started to feel like a human being. You know, I started to feel like...
Well, it's something place that encourages, you know, the thing you want to work on, the talent, even if it's, you know, off the sort of normal grid, whatever the hell that means.
Right.
But and also it's nice to have parents that support that, because I think not unlike your grandmother, you know, who said to your father, I think that parents get concerned.
They do.
About you know, pursuing that.
Well, yeah, and they were very real. I mean, don't get me wrong, they're very realistic too. I mean, mm-hmm. they loved that I was interested in music. They obviously knew that I had a singing voice, but at the same time, they knew that it was, you know, potentially meant for them. They'd never be empty nesters. So you know,
we got to get this kid out of the house.
Yeah, exactly. They,
well, did you have a plan B? I mean, were you moving towards something? Did your parents?
I was accepted to Carnegie Mellon University for theater. You know, and
your plan B was acting.
My plan B,
great,
was,
yeah. Real joy.
They'd at least get me out of the house for 4 years.
Yeah,
you
right,
know?
Right.
So, but you know, no, there was a certain point where I realized that the arts had to be my thing. You know, because my grades were not great. So, you know, it worked out. I was very lucky.
So tell me about this Grammy thing that was the big break. I mean,
so
after the 25,000 thing, the Phantom, the fluke.
Yeah. So 3 weeks later, David called me and he said, you know, hey, you were great at that thing. Listen, I'm at the Grammys right now. This song is nominated for an Oscar. It's nominated for a Grammy. It's called The Prayer. Celine Dion and Andrea Bocelli are going to sing it at the Grammys. Anyway, Bocelli is on a plane stuck in Germany. He can't make it. Would you sing it with Celine until you know, he gets here? You know, I'm going, oh God, send me the song. Let me see.
But you're just like this 18-year-old kid. Now you gotta go sing with this, I don't even know what she is.
No,
she's on some other different plane.
A different planet. Yeah, totally. And I... you know, it's
she's like 9 feet tall,
he's
right?
Being invited to the mother ship. Yeah, she floats. She's just, you know, nice to see you. Kiss, kiss. You know, it's just wonderful, positive energy that comes from her. And
she's
so,
the good part of diva.
Yeah, exactly right. You know, she knows she's a badass, but she handles it, you know, with humility. But so, you know, I got the song. He sent me the song. This was before.
You didn't know the song?
No, I hadn't heard the song, and I'd hardly sung in Italian before that, you know, and so
it was in Italian.
Oh yeah, my part was going to be in Italian, sure. And I had taken some classical voice training, but I'm thinking to myself, like I said, I was still very much a student. So
wait,
so,
classical voice training means you learn how to sing in Italian?
Well,
meaning that
you study the opera languages, you study the Romance languages, you study
but
singing.
Do you need to know what you're saying? Or
well,
no?
Sure, yeah, of course. I mean, that was the thing.
So you understand Italian?
Yeah, it's certainly when I'm singing in it, you know, I learn it backwards and forwards so that I know the full translation.
So you can have the feelings behind the words?
Yeah, exactly right. You know, you want to be able to close your eyes and sing. You don't want to have to look at the translation. So,
and you got to get the language right.
You got to get it right. So he faxes me, you know, this is before email, this is before MP3. So he faxes me the lyrics.
Italian.
He sends over a messenger with the CD, and I'm going, oh my God, because I was very much a baritone then, and Bocelli is like a primo tenor. So I said, you know, again, with the note, I don't think I can hit that fucking note.
David, I would be like, I can't. This is an Italian.
Yeah. So I said, David, I really don't want to embarrass myself at this really prestigious thing. So, you know, thank you. But this one I'm just going to have to pass on.
Yeah.
You know, just being so clueless. And I hang up the phone and he calls me back 15 minutes later. He goes, hey, man. Hey, it's David again. Listen, I don't think you heard me correctly. I wasn't asking you. I was telling, get your ass over to the Shrine Auditorium. You know, we'll see you there at 3.
You're 18?
I'm 18. He didn't give me any passes or anything. So I'm standing at the side Christ. Door with my dad saying, hey, I got to sing with Celine Dion.
But you're like, you don't have it in you to go like, you know, like, this is fucked. I can't do this.
Well, in my head I was.
You were? Like, sure. This is going to suck.
This is going to suck so bad. This is going to suck so bad.
It's going to suck right in front of Celine Dion. Well, right in her face.
Exactly right. Well, not only that, I don't know what happened between then and now. Now these award shows have become such an enormous thing. Now they're at Staples Center. Now you never see anybody that you're collaborating with at those things now. Now the dressing rooms are so far away, nobody watches rehearsals. At the Shrine, back when it was, you know, this was 1999, everybody was sitting out in the audience waiting for the rehearsal. So we had Madonna sitting out there. You had Steven Tyler sitting out there. You had, you know, all these people. That was the year Ricky Martin got discovered. And he's like, you know, just walking around backstage, you know, just...
It's a very small theater.
It
feels like show business.
Yeah, exactly. So I go up on stage and Celine saw that my hand was shaking. So she decides, oh, I'm going to take his hand and I'm going to move him to the front. Like I said, our choreography. So she was so sweet.
the sweating kid.
Totally.
Just walking through this.
Well, I'm standing on stage and they're wondering where the hell this Josh Brolin kid is or whatever. You know? And I'm going, oh, it's me. They're like, you? All right, whatever. Stand on the X. Celine will be here momentarily. And she just floats out on stage with her entourage and, you know, and the music just starts out of nowhere. And here's your mic. I'm like, oh, shit. And it was one of those things where just, you know, it happened. It came out. I did it. My dad's going, you knocked it out of the park. My dad was there.
He went with me.
Yeah, exactly right. You know, he drove me. He's the guy that had to convince the bodyguard on the side of the stage that I was actually allowed to go on stage and sing. Because, again, I had no passes.
And afterwards, he was like quelling.
Yeah, he was quelling. He was like, oh, man, you nailed it. You nailed it, Joshua, you know. And so we drove home. And again, I was just like, oh, man, this is getting crazy.
But what happened? What did Celine do after?
She was so cool. And she talked to me backstage and she said,
she didn't go, what the fuck? Where did that come from?
There's video footage of this too. Because my dad, again, and she was also very cool that she let my dad videotape the rehearsal, which having worked with a lot of divas, you know, since then, oftentimes those kind of rehearsals are, you can't film anything. And she was like, yeah, sure, of course, film will do this. So, you know, she was so supportive. She gave me such great encouragement backstage and just said, you know, you keep doing your thing. You've got a very unique thing. You keep doing it. And eventually people will pay attention.
Unique how?
I just think that she heard that it was, I don't know. She
I don't listen to enough singers like you to know, you know, what makes, you know, something, you know, translate. What do you think it is about you?
I don't, you know, it's hard. I'm too close to it too. You know, to be honest,
you read?
I don't know. I think my thing is that I think if I keep my voice in a certain place sonically, it has a I guess a sometimes there's a pathos, I think. There's certain voices that you just, and I know that the voices.
A melancholy.
Yeah, I guess.
A portal into those kind of feelings.
Into an emotion, into those feelings. Yeah, the voices that I love are the kind of voices where if you listen to them for 5 seconds, you just know who it is.
Like who?
I grew up listening to everybody from Mel Torme to Peter Gabriel to Bjork. You know, you just know. Pavarotti was a perfect example. There were 100,000 tenors at that time, but there was something that was, there was like a squeal. There was a quality to the way
it's
that he
sang. It's a gift, Joshua. It's a gift.
I've never seen it, quite frankly. I've always been really insecure about singing, and listening to myself sing is kind of the same way people are when they hear themselves speak on a...
Even now.
Absolutely.
20 million plus records later?
Absolutely.
Still like, nah, you don't want to... Can you turn that off, please?
When I'm doing the big orchestra sessions at Sony or wherever, I'll sing with them, and I'll get so much pleasure from singing. And then when they're playing it back, I have to step out of the room. I'm too hypercritical about it.
All right, so you do this thing with Celine. Dad's happy.
Yeah.
Foster's, he's got faith in you, obviously.
So then he has a story. Oh, my God, you should have seen this kid come out with Celine.
You got a story to bring back to the executives and the people in the world.
Exactly right. So we
got a Wunderkind on our hand.
Kind of. So
yeah.
We sang it. We did a lot of things together. We sang it at 101 charity events. We did a lot of events.
But that was his plan for you to get your chops.
I don't think he necessarily... Yes, I'm not even sure it was a plan at that point. I just think he had to do these things regardless, and it was great for him.
What
to
do you
have,
mean he had to do? He produced them?
He does a lot of events. You know, he's music director at a lot of great
music
events.
Music director.
Yeah, he's always lending his talents to charity events. We did a lot of,
So he had a thing in you in that, you were a new guy on the scene, you had a gift, and you were young, also he afforded you this weird opportunity to get some professional experience.
Oh, absolutely. It was a masterclass. Every day was a masterclass.
Mostly charity events and
charity events, some billionaires' backyards, whatever it was that he had to do at the time, I would drive up and
any opening slots or anything like that?
What, for me? I was the opening slot.
No, that's what I mean. On pay shows.
No, I never did the opening thing. I didn't even tour on my first record. It all happened so quickly.
All right, so you do how many of these events, you think, and what's the year span before you start recording?
Between 1999 and 2001.
You were just doing whatever he said.
I was just going to a ton of different things.
And the size of the orchestra would change. Sometimes you have a combo. Sometimes you have an ensemble.
Exactly. It was depending. It just was.
How
whatever,
much money was involved?
For nothing. I didn't.
No. For whoever was producing the event. So Foster would be hired as a music director. They'd say, "Here's the budget."
Yeah.
And he'd say, "Well, I can put together 16 piece here and bring
exactly.
this kid out."
Yeah, he would put
and
it together.
And "Wait, here's another budget. Well, I can bring a combo out. A guy at a keyboard and a drum."
Well, and I was always sandwiched between the between the headliners.
Who are these headliners?
Oh, they'd be in from Elton John. I remember one event I was sandwiched between B.B. King and Ray Charles. I mean, like, it was insane. I mean, I was the guy that they weren't expecting. It was always terrifying for me because I would look at the bill and I would go, oh, God.
But sort of weird. That's an eclectic kind of world of music.
It was.
That, there's a very specific, it's not even mainstream. These are usually journeymen.
Right.
Who have a very specific ability.
Yeah.
That is not going to offend anybody necessarily, and most of them are recognizable from the last 50 years or so of music, right? And they're not going to fuck it up,
right? No, of course,
right. So when you're working with somebody like B.B. King, do you have a conversation with B.B. King?
No, I didn't have a conversation with B.B.
Do you have a conversation with Ray Charles?
I didn't get to. No, of course not. No, I didn't.
Elton John, you have a conversation with Elton?
Yeah, Elton,
he seems to be very available.
I've gotten to know, and it's not even available. He's just super interested in all types of artists that come out. He knows everything about everyone. Every time he does his AIDS Foundation, he's got a new artist that he showcases on stage.
Yeah, he seems to be into it. I don't know if he was always like that.
I don't know either.
The prime of his career, but I'm talking to Josh Homme in here,
yeah,
and he's like, Elton's into me.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? Down there hanging, I'm like, really?
Yeah.
What the hell?
He asked me. We were backstage at something in London, and he said, "Hey, I'm doing a breast cancer event. Would you sing with me at this?" And I said, "Yeah, we got to sing your song together."
Duets with Elton John.
I sang a duet with him. I got to sing a duet with him. He did one of my songs, and I did one of his songs. It was tremendous.
He can still nail it, right?
Oh yeah. Oh man, he's incredible. I mean, he's one of those guys.
And he's on piano, and you're singing with him.
Yeah.
Wow.
It was beyond. It was a pinch me moment.
Yeah.
I've gotten to sing with people that I never expected.
Who else?
Oh, man. I mean, the people that...
I know on the record you did, you work with Herbie Hancock and Ladysmith and,
yeah,
and some other duets.
Yeah, I really, a very, very fun one was singing with Paul Simon. Paul Simon was always one of my heroes growing up.
Paul Simon's great.
He is great.
He's undeniably, like I don't even know what it is. Like, he's so uniquely himself.
Yes.
And has been all the way through. I mean, like his solo shit. I mean, I listened to the first solo album a lot.
Yeah.
With, Mother and Child Reunion.
Oh, yeah. There goes Rhyme and Duncan Simon. And
after. But the self-titled.
Oh, yeah.
I love that record because it was an A-track we had in the car.
Oh, really?
When I was a kid.
Oh, fantastic. I mean, that was the first, those were some of the first cassettes my parents would play in the house.
It's interesting because, you know, he has a very specific and kind of narrow vocal range.
Well, he's, you know, he tells his own stories like nobody else can.
Right. And, no, his unique phrasing.
There is
unique
something,
sound.
And there's something very sweet about the way he sings.
How do you play up against that with the momentum of your voice?
Well, I mean, we did, it was a thing we did at BAM in Brooklyn. We were honoring him. It was, a number of us got to meet the guys in Grizzly Bear at that time. That was before they'd blown up. And we all sang Paul Simon songs. It was the American Tune Week, where it was all of his Simon and Garfunkel and early solo work. And so I sang America at the piano.
By yourself?
By myself, which was a song I was doing in my
show. You played it?
Show anyway. Yeah, I played it and sang it. And then I sang a song that really kind of took him by surprise because he had never sung it live before. It was a song called Silent Eyes, which has always been one of my favorites. But he said to me on the phone, this is a song I never felt that I could redo after I had sung it on the album.
What album is that on?
He didn't feel... that was on, I think, Still Crazy.
Really?
Yeah. And he said, I never felt like I could sing that song live. So he was thrilled that I was singing that song, and he got Philip Glass to write an arrangement, and we did a whole thing with an Armenian duduk player and a Kenyan guitar player, and it was really, really interesting. And then we did Bridge Over Troubled Water together.
You did that. You did Garfunkel's part.
I was decidedly Garfunkel in the duo. Yes. And we did that one together, and that was
that fucking song always makes me cry.
It's amazing. It is.
It's like, you know, I'm crying thinking about it. Like, I'm getting choked up thinking about Bridge Over Troubled
Water.
It's
just, it gives you chills no matter what.
Because Garfunkel too had a very sweet voice.
Yeah. What a great range. I mean, yeah, amazing.
Surprising.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, they sang great together. So, higher voice than me.
But that's interesting. So you know, you work with these guys, you know, who are orchestral wizards.
Oh, yeah.
And arrangers.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, to kind of pigeonhole you as a schlockmeister is a little unfair in that I don't know that people quite understand that, you know, the voice is an instrument.
Yeah.
And that when, you know, you are, you know, being sort of guided,
sure,
by someone like Philip Glass. I mean, how do you work with someone like Philip Glass?
Well, it's a great challenge. I mean, we all have whatever our instrument is. We have to express it to its most honest core. For me to decide to sing rock or rap or something like that would not be giving my voice what it does best. And so I can certainly understand.
Was there a time where theoretically?
Yeah.
You could have been a front man in a rock band,
sure,
with that voice. That's been done before. There are guys with pipes that,
sure,
can really fucking do it.
Yeah.
Was that ever sort of like, was it not your music decidedly, or?
I grew up loving rock and roll. I put that in the drum category. I play drums in bands. Whenever I tried to sing rock music, I would lose my voice. I didn't want to lose my voice. And I also grew up listening to, I was inspired by both rock singers, but I was also inspired by some of the great classical singers, some of the great crooners. And I just decided, since specifically my goal at that time was theater, that I wanted to sing like the great theater baritones, and that was my goal. I was listening to George Hearn and Brian Stokes Mitchell and those people, John Raitt, and I just thought that's the guy I want to be. I would get chills when I would sit in an audience and listen to those guys sing, and I would think to myself, if I could have a really great pure baritone voice, that's what I want. And I still loved all these other kinds of music. It was just that
but there was something that you gravitated towards, the intimacy of true theatrical performance.
Yeah, it was.
That, you know, the
storytelling. Yeah.
The storytelling, but also the it's a different type of attention paid,
right,
to a vocal performance.
Right.
You know, when you got a rock band, you know, you've got to generate, you know, that thing that rock generates.
Right, of course.
In your own style, sure, yeah, but it's still sort of like, it's usually a clusterfuck of some kind.
Right, yeah.
And so, but you know, when you talk about, you know, theatrical vocals, whether they be classical or even in musicals and stuff, the type of attention that is brought to that type of singing is very respectful.
Well,
and you must have felt the weight of that.
I did very much feel the weight of that, and there was definitely a pedestal that I felt like I needed to put my voice on from an early age as far as just taking care of it.
Were you a Harry Nilsson guy?
Yeah, oh yeah, Harry Nilsson.
What the hell, where did that voice come
from?
Well,
just, I mean, the oddness of him was just so awesome to me. I just felt
like... Hell of a singer though, right?
Incredible singer, such an amazing songwriter, and so misunderstood for so many years.
Did you see that doc?
A great documentary.
Disturbing.
Totally.
When you tell me you were afraid to shred your voice, that the fact that, you know, that you have this instrument that you can destroy. You know, I think that in my life, you sort of misunderstand the need to protect that thing. You know, this is in your throat and in your lungs.
You can't polish it and put it away and burn the candle. It's you know, so your job is to go out and make it look easy. Your job is to go out and hopefully move people and reach people. But all the time that you're not doing your job, you're thinking about that very thing that you just mentioned, and it can make people crazy. Somebody like Steve Perry, for instance.
Jesus Christ, that guy could sing.
Has one of the greatest voices in any genre. And
how about that little Filipino guy that does?
Oh, he's amazing.
Is he Filipino?
Yeah, he's Filipino, but I don't think he has the mental demons that Steve Perry had. I think he came at it from a karaoke world, where he just fucking loved the songs, and he's just like, oh my God, you're going to give me this gig? He's enjoying every note that he sings, and I think that Steve Perry was tormented, and I think he mind fucked him way out of. I don't know. I have a feeling that it just got to him. The stress of what you were just talking about, the stress of how can I maintain this? Maybe he had a few off nights that just drove him crazy. I don't know. But
have you spent time with him?
But no, I haven't at all. I'm only
speculating
from my own personal experiences of the things that could possibly teeter you over the edge.
What are your concerns on your off times? Do you run scales?
I try to do scales, you know,
every day.
It's that fine line of working your voice like a muscle, of understanding the pressure that goes into maintaining your voice at a certain level, but then at the same time, not trying to be overly precious about it, not trying to view it as like this delicate vase that if you do anything wrong, it's going to shatter, because that's not true either. So sometimes you just got to sing. It was like when David told me to just sing the fucking money note.
Right.
You know, sometimes you just have to sing.
Right.
But... you know, so it's that balance. And I think that's why I say with the experience, now that I'm 33, I feel like I'm finally, my mind and my voice are finally starting to balance out a little bit.
Right. Well, what do you do to take care of your voice?
Well, some of it is simple. Some of it's just drink lots of water, get lots of sleep.
Yeah.
And some of it is just making sure you do the right scale regimens, however many times a week. Or if you're on tour, it's a totally different regimen because you're leaving a pint of blood on stage for 2 hours every night. Yeah. Your whole life revolves around those 2 hours.
Yeah.
Because feeling like you might lose your voice three songs in is not fun in front of 20,000 people. So
you felt that?
Oh yeah, I've felt that before a couple of times. All it takes is a couple out of 1,000 shows to really make you realize the pressure of what you have to do out there.
It's just you coming out of your fucking mouth.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's mental. I mean, it's all mental. There, you know, there's a reason why everybody sings so great at karaoke. It's just because you're mentally just out to lunch.
And you also got to do it once.
Yeah,
you got your song.
Yeah,
you nail it. Yeah, I was talking to somebody else about that. If you have a certain amount of ability, usually you can do something a few times.
Yeah,
you can nail it because you're so focused and nervous.
Sure.
But maintaining it
and
doing it over and over again, as a living. It's a whole different animal.
Man.
You know?
Sure. It's enough to hate it if you didn't love it so much.
Yeah.
You know?
So, okay. So now David Foster, he's got you running around, you know, doing the opening slot of charity gigs, the middle slot. You're working with, you know, real sort of wise veteran showbiz entertainers.
And that was at a time, now that I look back at it in hindsight, that was really a golden era. The final fleeting moments of this golden era in the music business where you could still sign a deal that was fair and that you felt like could actually lead to 8 albums and you could actually build slowly, and if your first album didn't hit, no big deal.
Right.
You know, now it's all about 360 deals, and if your first single doesn't...
What's a 360 deal?
A 360 deal is basically what any new artist has to sign now, which is that you don't just sign to make music. You're giving them your tour, you're giving them your merchandise, you're giving them your entire brand, essentially.
Because most of the money's coming from
merch.
Ticket sales and merch.
So they're in, you know, the music business is generally the content business now.
Yeah, it's interesting too, because like since most of the money, I imagine a lot of money was always generated by touring, but so much of the money is generated by merch and you know, the record sales thing has become different, but I imagine the challenge is not to run down your artists. or to allow yourself to be run down on a touring schedule.
That's your own. You've got to kind of be a judge of that, and you've got to have a great team around you, great management, and things like that.
All right. So what was the original idea? So now you've put some work in. You've got some chops. You've sung in front of people. And what is David Foster sits down and says what?
He convinces the record label, because he was VP there at the time, that this was something that he could make that would be a passion project for him. They believed in him, and they believed in my ability, but they didn't believe in it in a marketing way.
What was that discussion like? Like, how are we going to sell this kid?
I was blissfully unaware of all that at that point.
Yeah, but who were the guys in your world? I mean, who were the guys that the model was based on at that time? Feinstein?
No, I mean,
Harry Connick?
Yeah, I guess Harry Connick at some point. Andrea Bocelli had that one album that had been explosive at that point, Romanza. There was starting
but
to
he's
become
like this,
this three tenors that you right. know there was a time that there was starting to be a bubbling of this idea that traditional style of arrangement in music was getting popularized again, and so that was where David was trying to think 10 steps ahead, where the record label was still trapped in, you know, hey, we got this new song by Crazy Town, you know.
Yeah.
And so he was, you know, he's always had a great ability to know what's next.
Right.
And so we got started, and we got started at his house, and we just made a record by ourselves, you know.
So all the material that you do is written by others.
For that the first album, yes. Every album since then.
Were they all covers, or were some of them original pieces?
A lot of them were original.
Of my ignorance.
No, of course not. It's not at all. It was a really interesting thing, because I go through it now before starting any new album.
Uh-huh.
Now that there's a formula, I think to myself, how did we find songs and write songs for those first couple of records?
Because what is that formula?
Well, the formula now that you've had success is that people start writing for you. So you get CDs on your desk or MP3s in your mailbox that say, you know, for Josh Groban. And uh-huh. That's always a tricky thing, because sometimes they hit it, you know, because they explore and they go, you know.
And that's a big deal for you to do a song by them. It's a big payday for them.
Well, it's a payday. So you start to see that they listen to things that were successful, and they try to make a copy of a copy of a copy.
Oh, so you essentially can listen to what's being offered to you to see, you know, what's actually resonated.
What's resonated and what's, you know. And so, you know, you're either delighted or you say to yourself, God, is this what people think, or is this what people want? And then you say to yourself, all right, well, don't be lazy. You know, if this isn't what you want to hear, then you must know what you do want to hear. So get off your ass and write. And so that's when I started writing, and I've been writing probably half my albums since album two.
And that's Closer?
Yeah, Closer through all
the. So Closer was the first album that you wrote.
I wrote a few songs on that one. Yeah, exactly.
And what were you thinking when you did that?
I was thinking, well, it was an amazing door that was open for me. I was very shy about the writing aspect of it, and I knew it was something that I needed to hone. But I was thinking to myself, I was frustrated because the first album sold 5 million records, and the first album had this, all of a sudden people were taking notice. And so I was frustrated with the songs that were coming in. I didn't like them. And so I just decided to work with people that I was a fan of growing up. I went to France and worked with this group called Deep Forest. I worked with, you know, I did that, you know, song with Herbie Hancock. You know, I just wanted to work with people that I thought were great.
It's a good sound, that Herbie Hancock song.
Oh, man. Well, that was really fun. We had Herbie, we had the Tower of Power horn section. You know, it was just like, that was my first foray into like trying to sing with a groove. And sometimes with my voice, a groove can be kind of, you know, treacherous, but that was a case where we really, really loved it.
Again, forgive my ignorance. Have you gone into the area of trying to frame rock songs in your style, like Paul Anka did that album where he covered Nirvana?
Oh God, yeah. I don't know.
Have you done any of that?
Not really. Look, some melodies are just universal. Some melodies, whether they're rock, whether they're pop, country, are just so great that you could sing them in any style and they would still be great. Stevie Wonder has a lot of songs like that. I've covered a couple of his songs, but
which ones?
I did. I Believe When I Fall. Oh, I knew it.
It's a fucking great song.
It's amazing.
Art Garfunkel amazing. Covered that.
Yeah,
song.
He did. Yeah,
that's the first version I heard of it. Was Art Garfunkel?
Was Art Garfunkel? Yeah,
from Breakaway, which is a great record.
That's an example in itself that the fact that Art and Stevie could be singing the same song. It's just those songs are modern day arias.
That song kills me.
It's great. I love it. So
and the end of it on Stevie's version with those layers of
absolutely.
Vocals and synthesizers.
Oh, it's just like, going on and on.
And there's like a weird like funk ass groove in the middle of this. I love that build. I like songs that do that.
I like the ones that build like that too. I like the 7 minute epic, you know.
Love those.
Drives my label crazy.
What do you think was the first, like, Hey Jude sort of built that thing, right?
Yeah. I mean, all those bands.
But I'm trying to track the first time where because like when I was a kid and I first listened to Hey Jude, and you're waiting for like for Paul to you know, scream.
Yeah.
You know, and then it just starts that like you just want
when the song just takes a turn,
yeah,
to a street you didn't know you wanted to drive down.
Yeah,
it just, that's the best, you know.
Yeah.
And I love that too. And I try to find those kind of songs. And I try, when I'm making original music, I try to find stuff. You always want to give fans what they want to hear, but I prefer to give them stuff they didn't expect they wanted.
Yeah, but when you write your songs, which ones to you are the most personal? I mean, like out of the songs you've written, where you're like, you feel like you're putting your heart out there.
I felt like probably the album that I did with Rick Rubin, this Illuminations record, was probably the most personal. He really, really pushed me to write most of the record. And he said, you know, look, everybody knows you're a great singer. You know, make these songs from you instead of just being presented by you as a vocalist. So he got me with an amazing writer named Dan Wilson. He was the lead singer of Supersonic. He's got these amazing, amazing solo records as well. And we spent like, you know, 6 months together in Minneapolis at his house and just wrote a ton. And we would just talk about life and relationships and things that were pissing us off and making us happy. And we would sit at his piano and he had a guitar and we would just write. And so it was a very kind of bare bones, very kind of, we talk about that nakedness. It was a very different kind of record for me.
What was the orchestration? Was it just you and a piano?
Some of it was just me and a piano. Rick was really excited about the opportunity to work with, you know, full orchestras. You know, he had not ever worked with more of a traditional style singer like myself. So So he, you know, he had a blast, you know, at Capitol Records, you know, listening to the orchestra rehearse around him. That to him was just like a really fun thing. And so, you know, that
in
was
the old Capitol building.
The old Capitol building.
The old studios.
Those walls, man.
Yeah.
It's there's a lot of history there. And so, you know, it was great because I learned so much from him. It was a masterclass just from an A&R perspective.
From Rick.
From Rick, just listening to songs.
Like what?
I didn't realize at that point the importance of patience. I'm pretty impatient when it comes to making sound and making music. I want to throw the paint on the canvas, see what it sounds like, see what it looks like. And he would say, you know, let's listen to music. Let's listen to like a chorus that you've worked on. Okay, let that sit for 3 months. And if you still love it, he's of the mindset of, let's see if we can try and have hindsight before it's too late.
Uh-huh.
What it means is you're going to spend 3 years making a record, which, you know, my hindsight is I wish it had taken not so long. But it's great. It's a lot of time thinking about what your sweet spot is, and where your core is. And so, yeah, we had a great time. It was something that I'm not sure we would or should do again. But for that album and for that couple of years that we worked together, it was wonderful.
How did that album sell in relation to the others?
Not as well.
Why do you think that is?
I think that, you know, it was a bit of a curveball to my fans, and I think that it was marketed as not going to be a curveball, which I think was a mistake. I think
a curveball, what, in that they had not heard that, because Rick is, you know, it's almost like you feel like you're in the room.
He's got a very dry sound,
yeah.
You know, and everything, even if it's a full orchestra, it's like a full orchestra in this radio room.
Yeah, it's like,
you know,
compressed almost.
It's compressed, it's dry. And so, you know, there was a certain lushness, a certain largeness, I think, that the fans were used to, and a certain kind of style of song too. You know, when, like, anytime he asks me to go from some of the stuff that is, I guess, more of that old school style to let's write in a very new school way, you know, the fans were surprised by it, as I knew they would be, but I was expecting it to be marketed more towards like this is something we've tried and we're doing and this is a one thing, you know. And it was marketed like, here's the new record, you know. And so I think it was a little bit we certainly weren't shooting for radio or anything like that with this record.
But in those songs, though, is there a song in your mind that you wrote that makes you you know feel fragile?
Yeah, there's a song called Higher Window that was about a really bad breakup, and it was yeah, that was one that was one of the more emotional writing sessions for sure.
Now, have you done any of those songs from that record live? In a different production?
The live versions of the songs went great. You know, and that's what Rick said, is that we're dealing with a continuity here on this record. This is the style that I want to make this record sound like. But when you're live, all rules are off. You can add those drums back. You can add whatever else. And so, you know, when
boom, boom, bam,
yeah,
boom,
yeah,
boom,
get that gravitas back, you know. And so, of course, you know, after spending 3 years in a dry room, you get out in front of a live audience again, and you just want to add all the bells and whistles. And so, of course, the crowd goes nuts, and I didn't know I liked this song. You know? So, you know, you do your thing, but it was interesting because the combination of the way Rick worked and the combination of going back to the instinct of how I like to work, I found a nice happy medium of like there was something to be learned from that. I grew for sure working with him, And now it's okay to feel like this is what I do and this is what I want to do.
So who are your fans?
It's a good question. I mean, it's definitely shifted and gone from a very specific demographic early on, which I think was primarily older and primarily female, to, you know, the great thing about live performance is that you can go out and see who's out there. And I think in the last two or three tours, and I like to walk through the audience sometimes and talk to people and stuff, it's the whole family, which is great. Tony Bennett once told me, you know, if you can keep it a family show, like that's great, you know, get the whole family there and you'll be great, you know. And I'm thrilled for that. I'm thrilled that the whole family's there, and I'm thrilled when I'm surprised by people, you know, because I get, you know, sometimes I get my own, sometimes I throw myself into a box and I'll say, I'm going to walk out and see a certain type of person, you know, 1,000 times over, and I'll see the guy with the mohawk or whatever, and I'll be like, shit.
How many times has that happened?
Yeah, maybe once. But I love telling that story.
Enough for this story. He's there on a dare.
Yeah, totally. But even, you know what? I'll take it. You know what? If you walked out of there going, well, that guy's pretty talented, I'll take it. I don't care how you get there. It just, you know, and so, you know, I'm fully aware that half the audience was either there on a dare or there being dragged by a significant other. My goal is by the end of 2 hours for them to go, you know, that was all right, you know, so, yeah.
Well, yeah, I think that people's opinions are based on, you know, a lot of times a lack of investigation or close-mindedness of one kind or another.
100%.
And, you know, and then all of a sudden you're in that weird position and be like, I like the guy.
I'd never tweet about it, but I like him.
It's my guilty pleasure.
My
little secret.
I'll take that, sure.
Yeah. So, but now, like, when you do the thing you did with Jimmy Kimmel, you know, and the singing the Kanye tweets, or, you know, whatever you did with Tim and Eric.
Right.
I mean, is there part of you that thinks like, am I pushing the limit with my fans?
Yeah, a little bit. And part of that's okay with me. I think that, you know, first and foremost, when I'm dealing with comedic stuff, it basically just has to do with, is this funny? Is this going to make me laugh?
But also, like I said at the beginning, you're coming from a place where, you know, to most people who probably don't like your music, you are this, you represent that.
Right.
So to see you do anything outside that character, they're going to be like, oh my God, this kid's he's like a funny kid.
But I love that stuff. And I'm perfectly happy to take a pie in the face if it makes somebody laugh. And I think that, you know, if it's intelligently done, there are plenty of times where people want me to do like hey, sing like you for this thing.
Yeah.
And it's just not funny. It's just not, it doesn't serve any purpose. It's just, it's just, making fun for making fun's sake, and it doesn't have any intelligence behind it.
And it might be making fun of you.
Yeah. Well, yeah. You want to be in on the joke,
right?
You know?
Sure.
And so, you know, with the stuff you mentioned, and I just loved all the Tim and Eric stuff and love those guys. And,
but I have to imagine that, you know, if some of your fans did not come around for Illuminations, is that the name of the record?
Yeah, yeah.
That they're probably not going to come around for Tim and Eric.
But it's a different, first of all, it's probably a very different audience. I've probably got some of my core fans that are kind of looking over at the Tim and Eric thing going, that's kind of silly.
Yeah.
What's he doing? What's he doing over there?
Yeah. You know? I don't get it.
But it's okay. Anyway, back to.
Well, you seem just from the mild tweet experience I had with a few of your fans, they seem to be very forgiving you're a good sport, Josh.
They're loving. Well, it's just been them and I for 12 years. I mean, I've never been a press darling. I've never been an awards darling. So it's you know, they've had to put up with a lot with me. We've made some good moves, some wrong moves, and they've been by me ever since. And so. You know, yeah, I think that they enjoy, you know, I really do. It's interesting. I was afraid that they would kind of look at that stuff and shun me for doing anything that was in any way poking fun at our world or anything like that. But truly, they've got a great sense of humor and they love that stuff.
But also, like, I think there must be the issue of maybe because they, you know, fans project things onto you.
Sure.
You know, you represent something to them.
Yeah.
And they have you in their heart in the box.
Sure.
So, like, the fear of going out of that box or revealing something about yourself that might make them go, like, I didn't know he did that.
Yeah, but you know what? I think they all have that side of them secretly, too. I think we all have to have that side a little, even a little bit.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, my point of doing that kind of stuff, and again, the fear of will they like it or not like it, is not like, hey, guess what? I've been fooling you. I'm actually this guy. It's hey, look,
peel off your face.
I'm both guys, you know, and that's what it is. It's that...
Do you have things that you're like, you know, all my fans can never know that?
Well, I mean, you've got to have some things, you know.
I can keep that to myself.
I don't know. You know, I'm weird, you know. I think that, you know, but that's fine. I think that, you know, harking back to those days.
You got to have some privacy.
You got to have some privacy. You got to have some mystique, you know.
Sure.
I mean, like, I'm frankly thrilled that the paparazzi couldn't give two shits about me. I think it's the greatest gift that I could have been given in this business, because it just kind of, you know, they don't need to see me picking my nose. You know, it's fine. You know, I'm okay with that.
Well, that's a very small transgression.
Yes, yes.
You know, picking your nose, I think you could take that hit.
That's as bad as it gets.
Okay. But so what do you mean? You don't feel like you've gotten a fair shake from the awards and from the this and the, you've won a Grammy, haven't you?
No. Mm-mm. No. I may be one of those artists that never does. You know, I mean, I'm perfectly happy having my own lane. I'm perfectly happy keeping my head down and doing my thing. Sometimes when you're a little bit hard to define by the industry or by journalists or whatever, then the reaction to that is to confusion. The first reaction to confusion is negativity, and then it's a little bit head scratching, and then they say, okay, well, we like you, but we don't have any place for you. So frankly, I mean, I don't blame the Grammys, but at the same time, like, I look at all the categories and I see what goes into those categories, and I say, there just isn't a category. I don't know where I would go, because if I'm pop, you know, I'm in there with Timberlake and Bieber and all those guys, and if I'm classical, then I'm in there with, you know, Placido Domingo and all those guys. There isn't an in-between category. So there's no place that I could go where I would win.
But you want one.
Oh, I mean, sure, of course. Yeah. You know, it'd be great. But I'm okay. I'm totally okay without one. And I'm okay with, you know, the success, honestly, is fantastic.
Was the last record Illuminations?
Record was called All That Echoes. It came out last year.
Okay. Yeah. So that was after the one after the Rick
That
Rubin
was after
record.
The Rick Rubin record, yes.
And how'd that record do?
It did all right.
Yeah?
Yeah, it did fine. Yeah. It's fine. Business is tough, Mark. No, business is tough
right now.
Is it? Yeah, it's tough right now.
Come on.
The number one selling records in the country right now are only doing 2 million now.
Uh-huh.
You know, so back in the day when I was, you know, I said, like, I sold 5 million, 6 million records, that was a time when you still could.
The last window.
Yeah, exactly. If I sell 700,000, a million records now, I view that as a success.
How much are you touring?
I did 100 shows this last year, you know.
Jeez.
So, you know, I love touring. You make an album now so you can get out on the road. I mean, it's fun.
Does your old man go out with you?
Yeah, he'll come out sometimes.
Yeah.
I mean, anytime I can bring my parents out to something I'm doing, it's all happening in such a high pressure world for me that if I can see something through their eyes and I know they're in the audience, it's great. Cause I go back to those old stories and I just think, yeah, we did it.
We did it, Dad.
You knocked it out of the park. Yeah. Yeah.
What's your biggest fear about the future?
Well, I think that my biggest fear about the future is the same fear I had 10 years ago, which is that, okay, I'm going to do my thing. And, you want to be able to do it. Well, you know, I think that the success will come and go. There's always peaks and valleys, and I've certainly experienced peaks and valleys in my own success. But I think for me, I my biggest fear is I'll run out of passion. My biggest fear is I'll run out of inspiration. You know,
That's a hell of a crossroads.
Well, and then if I do, then I'll go do something else, you know.
Uh-huh.
But
like what?
I don't know. I'm not good enough with my hands to be a veterinarian. I don't know
what
I would.
When do you think about
join
that?
The army? I don't know. I don't know what I would do.
What do you like doing?
Well, I mean, I like comedy. Maybe I would just focus on doing some funny shit. You know, I don't know.
What are your hobbies?
I would love to host a show sometime. I loved doing co-hosting work and stuff. I did Never Mind the Buzzcocks in England. Did some stuff with Live with Kelly here in LA and in New York. And just that's always been fun.
Would you like to be a judge on one of those shows?
I don't know. Honestly, I.
What do you do for fun, man?
I love to fly. I fly airplanes.
You do?
Yeah, I'm almost done with my pilot's license.
Really?
Having a blast doing that.
Did you buy a plane?
No, I haven't bought one, but I'm using.
How much does a plane cost?
These planes that I'm flying, they're probably like 600, 700 grand.
Really?
They're expensive. They're
prop planes?
Prop planes, yes. Single engine, four-seater prop planes.
My God, you do that, huh?
I love it. It clears my head. The best decisions I ever make are within an hour of landing, because it focuses you. It takes me completely out of the creative side of my brain and puts me into this. If you don't pay attention to the numbers here, you're going to die. And I, you know, growing up, you know, very unfocused, you know, I've had ADD my whole life. It's like having this thing where I have to really focus and really dive into something that's totally non-creative. You know, you have to play by the book. is a great workout for my head, and it's great. It's freeing. You take off.
Any close calls?
Leave the earth behind. No close calls. Thank God.
Have you done any solo flying yet?
My first solo flight will be as soon as I get back to New York in about a week. So,
you living over there now?
I'm about half and half, I'm training in upstate New York.
Oh, so you go up there to a little airfield?
Yeah, well, it's a Westchester County Airport. It's a great airport there, and you can fly. You can either, you turn left and you're over the Hudson. You turn right, you're over Connecticut. So there's a lot of very great options as a student to fly over there.
Now, what compelled you?
I had met a couple of guys from Delta who said, hey, we're coming to your show. I was playing an outdoor arena there, and they said, hey, if you want, we train our pilots all night. If you want, come to the Delta headquarters, and we've got our flight simulators, or these $45 million 747 flight simulators. If you want, come hang out with us. We'll show you the simulators. The moment I finished my last song, I got in the car. I didn't even change. I went straight to the airport, and I worked with them until 5 in the morning, and they taught me how to land a 747. And I said, this is the coolest shit I've ever done in my entire life. I got the bug. I mean, it's a pretty cool way to get the bug, but I was like this, and I said, how does this translate to small plane flying? They're like, aerodynamics are the same. It's just you're dealing with, a
fewer switches.
Yeah, fewer switches. Yeah, exactly right. But the flying is flying is flying. And so he said, hey, if you were into this, go take some flying lessons, see if you dig it. And 40 hours, 50 hours later, I'm just still passionate about it.
All right, well, be careful, man.
Yeah, thank you. I'm trying. My mom's okay with it, so.
Oh, good. Yeah. Okay. Well, it was nice talking to you.
Great talking to you, too. Thanks for having me in.
That's it. That's our show. I told you he was a good guy. Go to WTFpod.com for all your WTF Pod needs. Check the calendar. I'll update it. I know the dates are a little screwy because some of those Oddball Fest tickets haven't gone on sale. They will go on sale. I will be go to WTF Pod. Go to the calendar because I can't read through it all. I got dates coming up in Lawrence, Kansas, which is close to selling out. St. Louis is sold out. I think I got a date coming up in Denver, but I'll keep it all up to date on the calendar. All right. Okay. Boomer lives.